Hello and welcome to A-Team Group's podcast on the evolution of the Algo Trading Desk, brought to you from our Trading Tech Summit in New York City on the 11th of June 2019. The podcast covers a panel discussion that details the development of algos, the challenges and opportunities of algo wheels, early thoughts on algos driven by machine learning and other types of artificial intelligence, and overall the need for greater communication between the buy side and sell side.
I thought we'd start by doing some introductions really quickly. I'm Bill Hartz, and my background is that I've been mostly on the sell side for my career, starting first at Goldman and then the firm that eventually became Citigroup and B of A, and with a short stint at NASDAQ. Most recently, I was the CEO of an organization called Modern Markets Initiative, which was basically an advocacy organization to sort of explain to people how modern electronic trading works. So. Anyway, I'll ask the panelists to introduce themselves also.
My name is Eric Karpman. I'm an independent consultant right now, but I've spent about 20 years in sell-side institutions, actually the beginning of my career, at Mizuho, then Bear Stearns, then Deutsche Bank. And then since 2012, I started doing consulting, and my clients are actually large hedge funds primarily. I would say the top 10 hedge funds in the world, you know, four are my clients. And I've dealt throughout my career in electronic trading, first building trading platforms for sell side and buy side, and then later on actually consulting my clients on how to utilize either vendor solutions or build custom solutions for electronic trading.
Hi, I'm Saurabh Srivastav. I work for Jefferies in the electronic trading team, so that's basic algorithmic trading. Prior to that, I was at BAML, and there I was in the fixed income commodities trading. Prior to that, I was at Credit Suisse, and I've been on the buy side and on the sell side in my past life, so both sides of the fence.
Vlad Gesturak, I'm from Cantor Fitzgerald. I'm head of electronic trading distribution and sales trading. Joined about a year ago, joined Catherine Zhao, who's Global Head of Electronic Trading at Cantor, as we've rolled out our precision electronic trading platform in the US and with many other plans. My background is a significant amount of time spent on the sell side, including BAML and UBS, all electronic trading. Additionally, buy side, I worked as a high frequency trader for one of the top players back in the day. And I was also a portfolio manager and the head of US trading for a family office based out of Chennai, India. That's pretty much it.
Thanks. So I think it's great. We've got this obviously fantastic depth of knowledge and experience on this panel. I'd like to start by sort of teeing up the issue or the question of how brokers are basically tailoring their business models to meet the changing needs of their buy-side clients. You know, in terms of client service, customized algos, what's the relationship and the dynamics between the sell side and the buy side? How is it changing these days? I mean, obviously, this is not a part of the industry that stands still for very long. Buy side has plenty of options and plenty of alternatives about where to send their order flow. And I'd like to, you know, try to understand how the sell side's adapting to that. So, Vlad, if you want to start.
Sure. It's important to open up that communication between the client and a broker, extremely important. The better relationship you have as far as communication between a client and a broker, the more you can do for the client and vice versa. The more you understand what they're struggling with or how you can be more helpful, the more you can deliver to them. And that leads us into a structuring how you're going to compose your team and where you're going to pour your resources. So obviously, you can take a look at specifically to your firm, where you are now and where you're heading, where your sweet spot is. Is it a small size hedge funds, medium size hedge funds, or do you service everybody? But from a general perspective, when you're talking about bulge brackets specifically, which handle sheer bulk of electronic trading volume, I mean, I think the changing environment, especially among the large asset managers who maybe have to comply with MiFID II, or maybe adopting the best practices around MiFID as far as evidence-based trading, where they're really focusing on execution quality, you need to sort of determine what type of player they are. Are they using wheels? How much of the flow is really directed by a portfolio manager, so the traders themselves, or they're purely looking at execution quality. So you typically separate your teams into those who handle, you know, quant systematic trading, where there needs to be not so much of a day-to-day handholding, except for maybe issue resolution, and more of a periodic review. And then you separate your teams to more of institutional level accounts, especially medium to large size hedge funds and semi-large asset managers, where algos are actually selected maybe by a trader themselves, so they require a little bit more of a hand-holding education about how algo works and trying to find out what serves better. I think where we're finding out the direction as far as staffing levels is that the more the sophisticated and larger the asset manager is, the more you're going to need to partner up with a quant on your team, somebody who will do bespoke analysis of their execution flow, providing really bespoke recommendations about how each algo can be tailored in order to fit the need. Not necessarily what you want to sell them, is what they really need from you and what your capabilities are. So there's quite a bit of a change happened in the past several years, but there's more and more data analysis takes place, especially for larger asset managers who are probably responsible for 80% of commission wallet out there.
Rob, did you want to say something?
Sure. One big shift that we are seeing in our space is the clients are now offering us more discretion over the order execution. So we are now building algos that behave like human traders would. So the algo then decides which sub-algo it would use, what should be the start and end time, what should be the schedule, what should be the participation rate, should he participate in the closing auction or opening auction, so those kind of things. So that's where we are, and so that's why the algo now is evolving and behaving more like human traders.
Interesting. Eric?
Well, I just add a perspective from the buy side, right? So I think, you know, I agree with Vlad that, you know, there should be more communications between the buy side and the sell side. But the sell side has an advantage. It knows the flow of the, you know, basically what the buy side is sending to them. So they can also be more proactive and acknowledge that and say, you know what, you know, we think that you can change certain parameters. So we think that there is a, you know, the additional, you know, maybe participation in the auction or after the market close, some participation or something else that can be happening. Or maybe we can recommend additional characteristics for the order to be provided to us. So that communications needs to take place. Plus, the buy side also is quite advanced right now, especially if we talk about larger hedge fund institutions or buy side institutions. That do great job analyzing after the day is over what their, you know, what, how their algorithms performed, which broker did better job sending parts of the order flow to different brokers and then comparing them. So they do like that very diligent job doing TCA analysis, doing analysis of the algos specifically for the brokers and making decisions whom to go with. So that communications needs to take place from both sides.
It's interesting, listening to the previous panel about Rule 606, I kept thinking, well, you know, why is the industry even counting on the SEC to dictate what data the buy side needs when in fact the buy side theoretically should have plenty of power over what data they can request or ask for,
or rely on the data themselves.
Yeah.
Right. So that's another aspect of this. So right now, buy side, you know, with all the ticker plans and all the real time market data that they receive, detailed market analysis information from alternative marketplaces and so on. So they have pretty much the same information that the sell side has, and they can do that independent analysis and validation of which broker is doing a better job.
Interesting. So, I guess where the rubber hits the road on all this stuff is how much you guys are spending on it, right? So, you know, it's like you say, well, we're, you know, doing this and building that. I mean, I know this adds up into real money for, for a Cantor or a Jefferies or whatever. And I guess the question I would ask is, do you feel like your clients, you know, give you credit for all that spending? I know it's a lot of money. Theoretically, it should translate into more business, right? I mean, how do you feel about that? Is it working?
I would say it's working. Like in our space, like besides investing on new algorithms, We also invest a lot of dollars on increasing transparency. So we do share a lot of data with our clients. So like, okay, all the child order details, like, okay, where we sent the order, where it was actually filled, what was the execution details. Then they take that data, they plug it into a third-party tool, like, let's say, Babelfish, which performs analysis for them. And all this provides for a quantitative basis for healthy discussion between us and the client. At the end, like Vlad said earlier, it's all about relationship. If the client doesn't trust us, then there is no business. So it is a very relationship-driven business, so transparency is very important.
I want to add to that, at least at Cantor Fitzgerald, because we're brand new to the electronic trading games versus equities, and significant amount of effort went into hiring the talent around quantitative analysis as well as development. Our money had been spent on building out Quantteam or building the algo platform, but also our next expansion will be increasing our capabilities around real-time as well as post-trade analytics, where we can add a tremendous amount of value. As far as the investment of dollars, whether they're paying off or not, it's actually not a question whether will it pay off. If you're not in this game, if you're not investing into data analysis and transparency, you're just going to be left out, because it's a bare minimum that our clients nowadays, especially large asset managers, that expect of you. So not investing is a mistake. Investing is a necessity. And then once you invest, it depending on quality of your product, and the people that are handling the servicing of that product and communication with the client will drive what the outcome will be.
Great point, great point. So a minute ago, I think, Vlad, you mentioned that you're seeing more and more clients using wheels, algo wheels. Maybe we could tee that up for a couple of minutes. This is a concept, it feels to me like the automation of something that's been done for a long time, which is evaluating brokers' execution quality and then routing or not routing based on, you know, certain criteria. Do you see more of your clients doing that now? Is that also going to be sort of the price of admission for large buy-side clients? To
of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's huge nowadays, especially with larger asset managers, that they're using some sort of wheels, brackets, some kind of learning techniques about how to route orders, even changing on the fly. I mean, there's various ways to accomplish it, but I want to go back to the initial point that I made. The better communication you have with the client, as far as more transparency, the better the outcome will be for them. Because we, as brokers, especially where we're investing heavily in technology and spending huge sums of money, we're willing to go to any length to make sure we provide a top-notch service and quality to the client. Now, conversations that I've had as somebody in my role, and I've had relationships across the street with many important players, is, if you're on a wheel, let's discuss how are you doing it. Is your PM selecting when they're sending an order to the trading desk, or they're selecting the speed of execution or the purpose of the trade? Is there an alpha in your trade? Does the execution trader have a discretion, even with a wheel, where they can adjust the settings? What is your benchmark? I mean, there is a dozens of questions and sub-questions you need to ask, and then you can determine what to recommend to them. And that kind of drives an understanding of what level of automation the client has and what sort of orders they're putting through the system, through the algo wheels or brackets or whatever it is that you call. And that's how we can be more helpful. But yeah, it's a definitely a huge transition over the past 5 or so years into sort of some kind of a systematic way of trading for whatever reason, maybe be a reduction in their staffing levels, where instead of having 15 traders, now they have 5 traders, and they decided some 50-60% of the flow could be relatively easily traded in a systematic fashion, and therefore the traders kind of acting more of a monitors, okay? Or is it the whole purpose and the sort of current wave of movement with wheels, where they're trying to remove sort of this human bias, the muscle bias, right? If we're going to be talking, you know, purely about execution quality, let's truly remove all types of biases and trade purely in execution quality. But it's here to stay, and it's only going to get bigger, I think.
Is it possible that a wheel mechanism could become a almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, in the sense that if based on prior history, it determines that a particular broker wasn't good in a particular sector, for instance, it might not route to that broker, even if the broker then, you know, becomes good, hire, you know, makes the right hires or improves their infrastructure or whatever. It seems like there could be problems there. I mean, I don't know if you've seen this, Saurabh, but how do you make sure that the wheel is reflecting what's really going to happen at the broker?
So it's, I think it boils down to, again, relationships. So what the way it works for us or worked for us in the past is the buy-side client, he or she, they reach out to us and say, you know what, you rank, let's say, you're at the bottom of the pile. So then we work with the client, like, okay, sure, let's see what we can do to improve our rating or ranking. So internally, we would go back, do data analysis, make some tweaks, make some changes, and we ask the client to give us another chance. So there is a lot of back and forth that goes, that happens, and with the hope that eventually we'll kind of bubble up in the ranking.
Have you had
So, I mean, the wheel is kind of a new term for something that's been around for a long time, right? So it's, yes, I mean, it's, I think, you know, the good word here is systematic, right? So it's just a way that you can proactively create your trading strategy from the buy side perspective, giving the feedback and information that I've just talked about before, where they've actually analyzed the performance from each broker and the transaction cost analysis results and things like that. But it's more than that, right? So there's a risk management aspect to it, right? So there's a counterparty risk, there's a different margining requirements with each broker. There are other things that need to take into consideration. The experience of the broker with a particular security that you're trading and the share market share of that broker in trading that security. There's a lot of other parameters that goes in, not just the historical performance, but historical performance is also part of that. So it's creating this sort of dynamic, systematic approach where you don't have to decide where to go when you have a specific order to fulfill, but the machine or an algorithm basically helps you to decide this.
Well, one thing that occurred to me was there's been some discussion of, you know, which orders should you put into the wheel and which should you not. And I don't know, when I thought about it, it seemed like, well, isn't you know, the mechanism of the wheel or the algorithms that are driving it, shouldn't those algorithms really be the ones to make that decision? But it seems like in a lot of buy-side shops, no, there's a manual process on top of it. Is that right?
Well, it could be, or it could be automated, right? So that's what I'm saying. So it has been manual before, but I think most of the funds, at least that I've consulted for, they've made efforts to automate that process, right? So when they look at what our counterparty exposure is to each broker, it's happening dynamically. So dynamically, they can reallocate, push, you know, part of the order to a different broker. Or maybe they feel that they are not meeting certain margining requirements with this broker or something. So it can happen, but it means that the buy side institution will have to go back to their algorithm, their smart order routers or their liquidity algorithms or whatever, seeking algorithms or whatever, and then try to adjust that based on their current exposures, their current risks, their current their feeling about a particular broker. Sometimes there are brokers that are not allowed, you know, the buy side institution is not allowed to trade with, right? They'll add them to a specific list that, well, even if the algorithm will show that we go with that broker, that should not be considered, right? So it's all possible to automate. It's just a matter of whether the buy side institution feels that there's value in it and invests money into this and goes in and adjusts those algorithms, creates this more systemically, universally acceptable for their strategies.
Great, thanks. Let's see. We'd also talked on our call, I guess, about the state of the OMS and EMS platforms today. I'll just tell a quick story. I recently saw a demo of a state-of-the-art OMS EMS, more EMS, but and this is a company that's been around for a long time, and I won't say who it was, but very highly respected, widely used across the industry. And what struck me about it was, and great piece of software, great workflow tool, but what struck me was how little
the feature function of what the vendor was providing has changed in really in the last 20 years, maybe 30 years. You can tell by the color of my hair, I've seen a lot of these systems over the years, and I was really sort of surprised that the feature function hasn't seemed to have changed that much. Now, from a sell side perspective, I mean, do you feel like there's value to be added in building your own OMS EMS platforms or adding functionality to things that you buy from the street? Or, you know, how does it look on your desk, for instance, you know, at Jefferies or Cantor?
So at Jefferies, we have our own OMS. And I do agree to your point that I agree that in the recent time frame, we haven't seen any earth-shattering innovation in this space, absolutely. But there have been a lot of small incremental innovation in this space. So like, for example, better UI, just to visually interpret how our order is performing in the market. So that's one thing. Then of course, we all are continuously either revising or writing new algorithms to basically address the constantly changing market microstructure landscape, because we have, right now we have 13 exchanges. There's another one, long-term stock exchange, gonna come up. Then after that, there's members exchange. So we have two new exchanges in the pipeline. Then
Miami.
Yep. And you have a new order type coming up every other day. We have new books. There's Mellow by NASDAQ that introduced recently. So there's always these changes. There's inverted exchanges, non-inverted exchanges. So we have to constantly modify our OMS to do the right thing, to make sure that, yes, we are executing the order on the right exchange, in the right book, using the right order type. So those kind of changes, incremental changes, are absolutely, they're happening continuously.
First of all, I think that there is actually a couple of solid players in OMS, EMS space as far as for the buy-side clients. Obviously, on the sell side, you have to make a decision whether you're going to be renting it or you're going to build your own. And it all depends on your maturity level and how much resources you have disposable. That's debatable. One thing that I do know, where I worked for Bulge Brackets before, is that it is extremely expensive not only to build the proper OMS that's actually very agile, you can adjust it to any kind of regulatory change or client needs and your algo needs, but maintaining it, because you have to staff it to a proper level, it's extremely expensive, and you have to really play a trade-off whether, you know, a vendor can fill that gap, and that's also very expensive. But the reason that hasn't been a tremendous level of innovation in this space, whether it's for sell side or buy side, is that, let's not forget the environment we're in, especially in the past few years. And for me, being in the current role, and I remember from BAML days, we continue to look at the buy side clients, and we're looking at our connectivity costs that we're picking up for the client. So if they're connecting to us via non-EMSX tool, then we're paying their connectivity costs. Now, maybe $1,000 a month for one client isn't a large sum of money, but if it's a per user fee or per share fee and they have multiple users, next thing you know, you're paying $50,000, $60,000 for each client. You really need to assess whether that client is the right partner and whether they're paying your firm is enough. So there's been tremendous renegotiation with vendors around contracts, obviously driving price lower, and I believe they're sort of a price takers. And we're continuously talking to clients and continuously, you know, having an adult conversation, cutting them off, therefore no longer paying fees to the vendor, because we, you know, under the sort of electronic commission pressure that we've been experiencing for years now, and now with MiFID II, where there is a separation between execution-only component and sort of a for services component of a commission rate, you really need to watch your bottom line. And as we know, things are expensive to build and maintain, and if there is no revenue growth and profitability growth for vendors, there is a limited amount of money they can reinvest in order to make their products sort of take that next leap. And I think that's the biggest issue, is the revenue, you know, commission compression, minimum revenue requirements from buy-side clients, and total connectivity costs are continuously being trimmed and renegotiated.
It seems like almost a real, almost an intractable problem, because from the standpoint of the vendor, they're looking at their sell-side clients and saying, well, why should we invest in this platform, because the sell side is cutting back on the size of their desks? And then from your standpoint, you're saying, well, I've got fewer people that need to be more efficient, that need to work more efficiently to cover all our clients in the best way possible. And for that, they need better technology. It feels like it's a tough problem. Are you seeing it on the buy side?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to go back to your point, OMS, CMS, so that you said not much changing. So, I mean, I agree that maybe not that much changing, but at the same time, I see two trends within the OMS, CMS space. One is that they're trying to, the vendors are trying to basically automate many processes, right? Moving further from their initial order management and execution management space. They're basically covering the entire trade lifecycle with their systems, right? They're moving into risk management. They're moving more actively into compliance. They're moving into some clearing and settlement functions. They're moving into booking functions and so on. So in many cases, that's what I'm seeing with OMS, EMS space, that there is much more, you know, more growth into non-OMS, EMS area, traditional non-OMS, EMS areas. And the second thing is they're trying to basically move into additional asset classes, trying to move into additional geographies, trying to provide customization for algorithms and other things that before the buy side, you know, the vendors covering buy side were offering just standard VWAP, you know, TVAP, things like those. Now they're providing an ability, like almost a toolbox with which you can build your own algorithms. So those are the changes that I'm seeing in the OMS, AMS space.
Great. So we're at that part of our panel where we'll try to take some questions. And I'll remind everybody, you can use slido.com. There's an app where you can submit questions. So we have one already. How are high liquidity flows such as cash equities and FX algos evolving compared to other asset classes? Anyone want to take that? I guess the question is, you know, what's the differentiation between equities and the other asset classes?
I could take a stab at this because I was a commodities trader in a past life. So I think one big difference would be the whole market microstructure. That's very different in equities compared to fixed income, for example. And of course, there is CME. It has its own order types or ICE, but it's nothing compared to equities. It's just very different, let me put it this way. So the algos are different. And then in commodities landscape, you have something called last look. No such thing exists in equity world. So the algos cannot use it to their advantage or disadvantage. So that'll be another difference between the fixed income or commodities algorithm and equities algorithm. Of course, equity is much, much more regulated than fixed income, FX, for example. So there's those kind of differences, more regulation in equities versus the other fixed income, other commodities. Those will be the highlights.
I just wanted to add maybe one thing. So what I'm seeing is, yes, those buy-side institutions that have invested into cash equities and other FX and other liquid strategies, right, and they've built algorithms for those, they're now trying to piggyback of those algorithms because they're seeing more liquidity in certain fixed income strategies and certain other asset classes. And they're trying to like, well, we've already built a fixed engine. We already built an algorithmic framework of some sort. We already are able to receive and interpret market data in a low latency fashion. Why not utilize those same channels of receiving information in creating algorithms for different asset classes?
Makes sense. So here's another question about, I guess, Vlad, what you had mentioned about the connectivity costs. You know, is that really a function of how the buy side is paying? Is it a function of paying through their OMS fees, their EMS OMS fees, versus directly from the manager?
I think it's a big issue, and it's directly yes. Going back to what I said, we are in a fee compression environment. Volumes have been stagnant somewhere around 6.87 billion shares across, you know, tape A, B, and C. Even during volatile days, we don't see the volumes that we've seen back in 2009, 2008, and I don't think it's coming back because a lot of players have been forced out of the market. The shop that I, you know, I was a high frequency trader, I can tell you they're no longer in business simply because it became very tough. Partially because of technological innovation, some of the alpha has disappeared, and co-location by brokers, which was the right thing to do. But yeah, I mean, because banks, especially if they're publicly traded, they're under pressure to make a profit. Everything is scrutinized. I can tell you that I regularly review costs associated with connectivity because it's a huge portion of our revenue overall on expenses. And I regularly have conversation with my sales and sales traders about having a grown-up conversation with the client, you know, to show them that we really want to be their partner. We don't mind if they need time to, you know, sort of grow in certain size. And we don't mind working extremely hard to get us where we need to be in order to be part of their regular trading routine or included in their bracket or wheel or whatever it is. But if eventually you have to make some very tough decisions. Now, one of the ways to do this is to work with vendors in order to get educated what value they're providing to the client and understanding how the client handles their workflow. And this way you can potentially have another way in to be a partner with a client. But it is right now purely driven that broker picks up the tab for most of the connectivity. And then if there's a lot of users, if the economic agreement, you know, if the contract is such that it's per user, and on top of it, you know, you pay maybe say 10 mils per share. And if the volume is not there, and especially if the client comes in and says, I only want to pay 25 mils, then you really, and then on top of it, if you're truly trying to do a right job with not route based on rebates, which, you know, you got to be transparent. And you've got to do the right job based on the trading and performance, not based on how much money you're going to make on rebates. Then it becomes part of a very difficult conversation. And I don't really have an answer how to change the model right now, to be honest.
Do we have time for one more question? We'll answer one more question, I guess. So we actually did have another participant, who John Crouch from Ideal Predictions, who unfortunately, I'm told, hurt his leg and wasn't able to participate today. He was going to talk about AI and trading algos, but I know our panelists may have some thoughts on that, and sort of goes to this question, you know, could improved algos be made using genetic algorithms? What do you think about that? Where are we in that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the natural step, right? So you're starting with genetic algorithms. You're seeing that sometimes you're not getting the optimal execution out of them. You do the analysis of why this happens. You try to understand the microstructure of the trades and you know what's happening, the market data analysis, transaction cost analysis, and you're seeing certain conditions and characteristics of how to improve the genetic algorithms, and then that's just a natural step moving from static genetic algorithm into more dynamic algorithms with some custom twist to them.
But I think the short answer is yes, but I think longer, more intertwined answer is it's a very hard problem to solve. So I know, like for example, JP Morgan, they came out with this white paper about machine learning and AI, I think last year, the year before. Most of the folks that I'm in touch with, they are using ML or AI stuff for hyperparameter optimization. Other than that, all of us are, I should say, the ML and AI work is in progress, work in progress. But there are very few algos that are actually in production where you can say, yes, this is ML algo that's spitting out these orders which are making so much money for us. I haven't, at least I'm not aware of these. But like I said, but I do know like all of us are doing using AI and ML for all our algo parameter optimization, absolutely.
Speaking about generic algos, so that's a starting point for everybody, for all the brokers who are offering electronic platform. There are two problems that could be solved with that. Using generic algos as its own individual modules and try to replicate human behavior. So if you're talking to a client who wants to focus his time on difficult to trade orders, but somewhat the relatively easier orders he wants to hand off, but they don't have a wheel, he says, okay, if the price moves 2 basis points, you do this. If it does something else, you do something else. So you're using generic algos as a building blocks, and you have some kind of a transition mechanism. So that's one problem solved. Other one is going back to what I've been emphasizing, and I talk to my clients every day, all day long, is, well, not my clients, firm's clients, let's just be clear. What is the benchmark you're trying to hit? If you're not trying to do something complex where you're using your experience around trading and how you're handling orders, weaving and bopping, if there is actually a benchmark, then yes, generic algos is a starting point, but then you start fine-tuning, whether it's a microstructure fine-tuning, which venues you're routing, how long you're sitting out there, whether you're doing a simultaneous or parallel routing, to actually how passive, what is the level of participation. I mean, the parameters are endless. But again, it goes back to creating a true partnership, and the true partnership starts with a conversation.
Thank you for listening to our podcast on the Algo Trading Desk. We hope you found it useful. For more content and comment on trading technology from A-Team Group, visit our website at ateaminsight.com.